Thank you for listening to the CPA Trendlines podcast, a production of CPATrendlines.com, now available on iTunes. CPA Trendlines presents an episode of The Disruptors.
Welcome to Accounting Disruptor Conversation. I'm your host, Liz Farr from CPA Trendlines. My guest today is Megan Jeanne Tarno, founder of the Mobius Group and industry lead for the nonprofit accounting group at Hard Rock Accounting. Welcome to the show, Megan.
Hello, Liz. It's good to see you.
It is so good to see you. So good to see you too. So we've got a lot to cover, and we were chatting before, and I know that we both have a lot of passion for this topic, so let's get started. Accounting talent in the U.S. and around the world has been really scarce for years. COVID and the Great Resignation made it worse. What are your ideas on how to make things better?
I'm going to pause there a little bit because I was thinking about this and realizing I'm sort of fascinated that there are people who want to go into accounting, that they're like 18-year-olds who like, this is what I want to be as an accountant. Because and I've met some, right? And there's definitely some in our firm. And when I was 18, coming out of high school, there is no way on the planet that I would have wanted to be an accountant. Right. It sounded so tedious and so boring, you know, and she goes, does that mean? Yeah, it is.
Well, you know, sometimes the tedious and boring part appeals to some people, because when I was 17, I thought I wanted to go into accounting.
Okay, tell me what the driver was. Why did you want to go into accounting at 17?
At 17, I was the bookkeeper. Well, I kept the books. I wasn't really a bookkeeper. I kept the books for my Explorer Post and my Girl Scout troop.
Okay.
Both of them were running businesses. And somebody's mom taught me the basics of double entry accounting. And I really liked it. It really made sense to me.
Yeah.
But I grew up in Los Alamos, New Mexico, the home of the atomic bomb. Business and accounting was what you did if you weren't smart enough to get a PhD in physics or be an engineer. So, like all my friends and my family, I went into biochemistry. But okay. Here I am in accounting now.
But I think that story of what made it interesting to you, I mean, I think it's just the timing, right? Because that's very similar to what brought me into it as well, right? And I grew up in a family small business and was working for my dad from the time I was 10. But honestly, I don't know who did their bookkeeping. And actually, I'm not sure anyone did, because I found out when I applied to college that he was a few years behind on his taxes. So I'm not sure anybody was doing the bookkeeping. But it was years later. And so I went to college thinking I was going to be a modern languages major, and then wandered all over. And when they finally made me pick a major, I'm like, well, what am I the closest to having enough credits for? And ended up with a theater degree. But years later, I was got hired by an Asian American theater company, and everybody's a director of something. And I was the person whose job was everything else. And that included, you know, the finances and a variety of HR and IT and all the other things. And it was like 1996. QuickBooks had only been out for a few years. They'd already destroyed it and were in the process of working with a consultant to reset up their books. They actually had a good one. They had a really good consultant who knew what he was doing. And I got to work with him through that process. And then we had a board treasurer who was the CFO for Banta Publishing. And he too was like, these are the reports I need to see, and this is why I need to see them. And we had a great auditor who was like, this is what was wrong this year, and this is how you fix it, and this is why we do it that way, right? And so, you know, just like you, when you were 18, to me it wasn't math, it was puzzles. It's like, how do we put the right puzzle piece in the right spot to make everything, you know, it's almost like working a Rubik's Cube or something. Like you have to get things into alignment so that all the other things will work too. But I don't think we don't sell it to kids like that. Oh. Right? It, from the outside, it looks like it did to me, like, oh, it's just ticky box compliance.
Mm-hmm.
And me.
Yeah. So how do we make it better? How do we keep the talent that we have? How do we find good talent?
Honestly, if I'm to tell you the truth, a lot, this has changed over the last couple of years, because as I, you know, got to meet the folks in Accounting Salon and moved into High Rock, I've met more people who have wanted to be accountants from early on, and maybe they had an experience like yours, or a family member was an accountant, so they saw the interesting part. Because up to that point, the majority of the accountants I'd met had been like, somebody forced them into it. Like, they really wanted to be a flautist, but someone said they had to be practical. So they got an accounting degree instead. And then there were a handful of people that were always the ones that really appealed to me. And they did not come out of traditional accounting backgrounds. They were dancers or philosophy majors or women's studies majors or archaeology majors who'd fallen into it sort of like I had and just grabbed on because they're this whole, you know, for the same reasons. And then, in some ways, I think went deeper than the people, you know, than the other folks I knew, because they had to, because they were curious and they created, like, they wanted to understand how all the pieces went together and why. And maybe that's what we do when we're training people. We stop just giving them a checklist. Then we take the time to help them understand how the small piece that they are doing impacts the larger piece. You know, maybe we start hiring for curiosity instead of compliance.
I think that's a really good way to do it. I worked as a mentor to several people through the New Mexico Society of CPAs, and they always paired me up with the ones who came from a very different background. There's one woman who was a dancer, another woman who was an analytical chemist. And they found themselves needing a new direction, but they did have the curiosity and the desire to put things together. So you may be onto something there.
Honestly, one of my favorite, my personal tax preparer and one of my favorite tax people who hides on tax Twitter because she doesn't want other clients to know she's on there. But her experience was very similar to mine, right? She was a young rebel working in the box office of a puppet theater when the finance person quit. And you know, the head of the theater was like, well, you're not afraid of the calculator. This is your job now. You know, and she, right? Could have gone terribly awry. But she leaned into it and was curious. And when the folks came to do the 990 and the audit, she asked a lot of questions. And the auditor said, you know, you seem to have the right characteristics for this. This might be something you choose to pursue. You know, and then was able to, work her way up, got her degree, is a phenomenal tax preparer and CPA now. You know, so maybe it's one of the things we do is we start paying attention to the bookkeepers around us and the people who are doing finance but don't see themselves as financial people. Mm-hmm. And we open up that door of possibility. At Accounting Salon this year, Brittany Brown did a great session on leadership and did case studies of four people within her firm who had risen up to be leaders. And most of them, if not all of the ones she highlighted, like, did not necessarily have deep professional careers. They were coming, you know, right out of college or had been homemakers for several years, raising kids or starting off as bookkeepers in her firm. And she saw those qualities in them and moved them up and promoted them.
Yeah.
You know, gave, you know, fed them and trained them and invested in them, absolutely. And like helped them become the leaders she needed in her firm.
Yeah. Now you bring up an interesting point that kind of segues into my next question, which is, you know, moving people up through the leadership structure. And that is that for years, accounting firms have run on this very rigid hierarchical pyramid structure. But you and I both know accounting firm owners, you know, Liz Mason is a great example of people who are breaking that and questioning that in many ways. And so what are some of the ways that you are seeing changes in the business model and the organization structure of accounting firms?
Honestly, I don't think we're seeing it enough. I was in a conversation with someone earlier this week about the number of people who like are unhappy in the hierarchy of their accounting firm. So they go off and they start their own and then they replicate that same dysfunctional structure. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think in some ways, because it's all we've ever known. We're told that's the way it's supposed to be. Like that is the example we have. And it's hard to imagine something you've never seen before.
Yeah.
Right. At HIROC, we're talking about doing it like, you know, there's, and I know as in conversations with Liz, and she's had people come in and she had these huge dreams, right? And I hope you get a chance to talk to her. And then people she brought in to help would start to force the company back into the traditional mold. Oh. And like tell her all the ways why she couldn't do the things she wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think that dominating culture is very, very strong. And it worms its way in and it wants to keep us all in line and keep us doing the same thing because that benefits somebody. I'm not entirely sure who. Right. We're talking about like flipping the org chart like upside down, where the leadership team is not at the top. The leadership team is at the bottom. The leadership team is the foundation and the roots of the organization that, you know, leads to and provides the strength and the nutrients and all the things that like feed the rest of the tree.
I love that image of the leader being the roots and the rest of the firm being the tree, because that's what we see the most of.
And I mean, don't you kind of love how, like, you know, this year's little twig, little leaf, you give it 5 years and it becomes a strong branch.
Yes.
And new little branches spread off from it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a nice image.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think that might be a really good way for people to think about it when they are thinking about different structures for their firm and different job titles. You know, who says that everybody at the bottom has to be a staff accountant and then you become a senior and then you're a supervisor and then you're a manager And then you're a senior manager. And then maybe, just maybe, you make it to the partner level. You know,
why do you know, Hierarch has kind of gotten, has different titles, but again, they're sort of those layered titles, right? Of you're a technician, and then you're a specialist, and then you're a pro, and then you're a master, and then you're a guru. And we started kind of joking around, like, what if we saw it almost more like karate belts? You know, or where you, like, you have to earn a belt to get to the next level. And you might be a black belt in tax, mm-hmm. but a green belt in apps. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, and that idea that you're not all one thing, that you might you have strengths and you also have weaknesses and places that you can continue to learn.
Yeah. And I think that there should also be room for people to make lateral moves.
That's a joke, you know, that we see that where, like, we take somebody who's really good at what they do and we promote them so they don't get to do that anymore.
Yeah.
You know, that Peter principle where you rise to your level of incompetence because we keep taking away the things you're actually good at and making you do more management.
Yeah.
And maybe there's a different way to manage teams. You know, what is, you know, are, can there be a more lateral, can teams be pods where they become sort of self-managing and people take on different parts of that leadership role and provide accountability to one another as opposed to, you know, we've got a layer of serfs and, you know, overseer making sure they all do their jobs.
I think there's room for some of that. And I sure hope that the next generation is a little more flexible in their outlook than maybe we have been.
You know, I think it gets tricky because we have internalized so much of that hierarchy and that structure that, you know, we'll say we want this other thing and then we want, but then we like demand to know where we live in the pecking order.
Mm-hmm.
Like we can't imagine that it just doesn't exist.
Right.
You know, so how do we help people still feel, you know, secure in their role and in their understanding that they have a place in this organization, but it's not as rigid and hierarchical as we've been accustomed to. There's no, you know, it's not competitive. We don't necessarily have to climb the ladder and push people off so that we can, you know, like, is there a more looking at that where no one has to win, right? In the organization, it's like, you know, the pitcher might be the coolest player on the baseball team, but it's not going to work unless you got the rest of the team on the field, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And you bring up kind of a point of, you know, just moving up for the sake of moving up. You know, many firms start with the precept that you have to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure that every firm really does need to grow. And what do you think about that?
I think it's worthwhile, to consider why does your firm exist? And what mm-hmm. is your, you know, what is your dream and your vision for your firm? And there are certainly people who like want it to grow, want it to be this big thing. And okay, that's a valuable thing, but that's a different kind of firm than one that says, I want to provide a wonderful place to work for my employees. And there's mm-hmm. however many of them. And, you know, and statistically, I mean, studies have shown that like there are kind of ranges where things change in an organization. Like you can be so, oh, and then there's a new level at 5, maybe, and then there's another level at 12, and there's another level at 20, and each of those are different in the way that has to be organized. And 150 is completely different again. And like, you know, do you want what that means if your firm becomes that large, right? And what's the why? Why do you want it to be that large? You know, and some things maybe you can only achieve at scale. Maybe like it's just your dream to grow something really big and see what happens. Maybe you're trying to sell it and you think it's going to be more appealing to someone else. If it's larger, I don't know if Clayton got into this, but he was talking at Accounting Web about the finite and the infinite game. Mm-hmm. Like, what game are you playing?
Yeah.
And I think far too many of us are playing a finite game where somebody has to win. And wouldn't it be more interesting to play an infinite game where our goal is to keep the game going and continue to interact with the other players and, you know, not drive ourselves crazy so that we are, you know, fleeing the profession.
Right. Yeah, I think that there are a lot of firms that lose track of where they are and what they want to be. When I was at Digital CPA in December, I met somebody who had a firm of about 20 people, and he confessed to me that he was just miserable. He hated it, but he didn't know what else to do.
Yeah, I was there and I sold my firm and became an employee. And I'm basically still doing the same stuff, right? I'm still leading my team. I'm still interacting with clients, but all of the decisions aren't mine anymore.
Right. Right. And that's a perfectly reasonable way to grow, not just to, you know, you don't have to be the one on top to grow through acquisition. Mm-hmm. I think that you can also grow by merging into another firm.
You know, and I wonder if there's, you know, is there another model altogether? Is there some sort of synergy between like-minded firms where they share resources and pass, you know, clients and prospects in a more So that everybody's got enough, mm-hmm. You know? I mean, I've had messages all day with a guy who desperately wants to grow his practice and he doesn't know where to get clients. And I know plenty of other people that are like, I am swamped, you know? Mm-hmm. Maybe we don't all have to do our own thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe we can be the resources for somebody else. Mm-hmm.
But I think that's a very, you know, I'm coming out of the nonprofit sector, Liz. So I live in St. Paul, Minnesota. So there's been a lot of conversation in my sector over the last several years about diversity, equity, inclusion, and, mm-hmm. you know, what definition of dominant culture and how does that show itself in our actions and our behaviors and the way we interact, and how can we start to address that and challenge that, or even just notice it so that we can then make decisions as to whether that's something we want to maintain or not, or if there are different ways of doing things that existed already and we've just pushed to the side.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now we've talked a little bit about the things that accountants need to do to become good leaders. Mm-hmm. You know, it used to be that to be an accountant, you had to be really good with the 10 key. And before technology, you had to keep the IRS regs practically in your head. But now we see a very different kind of skills. What are some of the skills that accountants need to be successful today and in the future?
I mean, I think they definitely still have need technical skills, right? Just because we've got fantastic accounting software, it doesn't do the accounting. We still have to understand the accounting behind it. So we can't, but I feel like technical skills are table stakes. Like that's just assumed. You've got to have those. And beyond that, I think it's soft skills. I think curiosity for me would be my number one. Wanting to learn more, wanting to understand how the pieces go together. And interpersonal skills, right? We are holding, if we're working with a small business, for example, we are holding that business owner's dream in the palm of our hands.
Yes.
You know, and I talk with our nonprofit clients. It's like nobody starts a nonprofit. Nobody starts a business because they want to keep the records, right?
No.
Except weirdos like us. But most people, that is not why they start a business. They have this thing that they want to see exist in the world. And so they start. And so at the same time, financial knowledge empowers them. Right. I think a lot of them were like me, who I bailed out of math as soon as I could. Right. And so we're like, oh, I'm not good at math. And you're like, that's fine, because accounting isn't math.
That's right.
Accounting is puzzles. And I'm pretty sure you're good at slotting things, like understanding how multiple things go together, because you're a business owner. You know, and so being able to put ourselves in the other person's shoes and look at it from their perspective, like to be able to channel that time when we didn't understand it all either. How can we communicate? How can we communicate this, you know, compliance that they have to do, and also channel the ways that it empowers them in their business?
Yeah, so it's about helping the business owner create what they want. Or if you work with individuals, it's about helping them to achieve their dreams.
Yeah.
And to set out a plan so that they can put their resources in different buckets that will become more valuable in the future.
And help them achieve their dreams, right? Because granted, there's all of that increasing amounts of compliance lots of, you know, average people have no idea it exists, much less what it is they should do. So in some ways we're a translator. I'd love to see more of us become knowledgeable and push back against, like, there's some compliance that is, we need to be asking ourselves, why does that exist? You know,
right.
There's plenty of stuff that, I mean, in the nonprofit sector, right? I feel like we treat nonprofits the way we treat poor people, which is that if we don't watch them like a hawk, they are going to take that money, you know, the money they don't deserve.
That's
right. And do something we don't want them to do with it. And I feel like we should really be challenging those assumptions as well. I would love to see more of our skills and our talent support the leaves on the trees, instead of all going to the folks that already have plenty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, after all, nonprofit, as one of my writing clients has explained to me, nonprofit is really a tax structure.
Yeah.
It's not really a business structure, but it's the compliance around that tax structure that is so complicated.
And there are those who look at that compliant. You know, there's always the people that are the reason we have rules.
Yes.
Because right? Mm-hmm. If we don't specifically say, no, you can't do that, then they will. Okay, not a rule against it, you know. And I feel like the very first rule was just like, don't be an ass. And every other rule has been explaining what we mean by that, because somebody always has to push it. And the whole basis of modern philanthropy was rich people wanting to have say over where their dollars went and how society mm-hmm. developed, and they didn't want to do it through taxes. They wanted to have control. Mm-hmm. So it's complicated and could use some more smart people, you know, drilling in and pondering that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a lot of things that accountants do that are probably counterproductive to that. What do you think accountants should stop doing immediately?
Not eating at their desks.
Oh, that's a good one.
We should stop eating at our desks. We should stand up and we should get away and we should get back, even if we just take a walk around the block. Because I think we put on the hair shirt and we talk about how many hours we put in and all of that. We should stop lobbying against free file. You know, there's tons of people in, like, the government has all the information they should need to simply file their taxes. Yeah. And there's certain places in Europe, what they do is they send you a postcard and here's the information mm-hmm. we have. Does that look right? Contact us if it doesn't. I think there are things where we are, I don't know, we haven't gone into it, but like with the billable hour, right? The billable hour puts our, puts the needs of us and the needs of our clients at direct odds. The incentives yes. are directly antithetical. And I think mm-hmm. there are other things in our industry where that is true, where our best interest and the best interest of our clients are at odds. And mm-hmm. what if we actually put their best interest first? Like, what would that look like? I think there would still be plenty of work.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know an accountant who's going, oh, I mean, there are a few just starting. As an industry, we're not going, oh, there's not enough for us to do. Or there's far too many people trying to do this tiny bit of work. Like, nobody's saying that.
No. Oh, no. 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 I remember even when I started out at H&R Block, and when I would get there at 9 o'clock in the morning, we would have enough people lined up outside the door to keep us busy until about 11. And we were cranking out tax returns. We could do them in about 20 minutes because they were, like you said, the pretty easy ones.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of W-2s, maybe mortgage interest. The most complicated part was figuring out dependents and family relationships, which can be a little tricky when you have multiple generations and multiple people living in the same household, earning money, and trying to figure out, well, who should claim which kids? Can I claim my grandmother? Can I claim my grandfather? How about my cousin? How about my girlfriend who's lived with me all year and hasn't worked?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was that was the challenging part. So,
And it just goes to show how the tax code has historically given precedence to the way, you know, wealthy white people live their lives. And not how to the way, you know, the much more complicated family structures of, you know, people with less money and, you know, people of color, both. There's a great, I keep pushing it on tax Twitter, but I really, The Whiteness of Wealth by Dorothy Brown, by a Black tax accountant who just did not realize for years, even after she became a tax accountant, it didn't hit her, like, how the system was stacked against folks like her parents and how it developed to be that way. And I don't know if that's common knowledge for folks who actually do tax or...
There was a guy in our H&R Block office who, one of the other preparers, who said all of this is social engineering. The tax code is social engineering.
And the people who already have a lot of money have their finger on the scale.
That is true. Oftentimes. Now, accountants often know what they need to do to change. They know that they need to change their business model. They know they need to be a better manager. They know that they need to fire certain clients. They know that they have to stop saying yes to everyone that walks in the door. But they don't. What do you think are some of the things that keep accountants from making those changes?
I think deep down, like, the vast, vast majority of us are really good people. And we're helpers. We're essentially in a helping industry. So we don't want to do anything. We will sacrifice ourselves to keep from hurting someone else. Right? We don't want to let our clients down. We don't want to let our teams down. We will fight and push through and do all of the things so that we can try to hold everybody up. And which is good in a lot of ways, right? But I think we're not, but that's not always helpful. I mean, it's certainly not helpful for us. And I don't know that it's always helpful for the people we're trying to help.
No.
It doesn't actually get them what they need either. And that if we could pause and do a big reset, all of us might get closer to the things that the life and the businesses that we actually want.
Exactly. Now, for the last couple of years, client accounting services, client advisory services, CAS, whatever you want to call it, has been really big in the US. Now, I want you to get out your crystal ball and tell me what you think will be the next big thing.
I'm not sure how good a crystal ball I have, Liz. I don't think we've reached the end of client accounting services. I think that's still huge. And I think a deeper integration between client accounting services and business advisory and tax, I don't know that it necessarily, like, I don't know that it needs to be the same people. There are folks who, man, who adore, who love putting, they love the transactional stuff. And asking them to then do tax planning. You know, isn't their best and highest use. Is not really their zone of amazingness either. So, but those tighter integrations where we can partner with each other, we can refer a really good bookkeeper or a really good tax planner, or so it's relational, it's networks. it's getting out of your silo and finding finding your people whose niches are slightly different than your own, but that can feed in and support your clients.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to just like build a stronger structure around them that is less competitive and more supportive with the real needs of the client in mind. I would love to see that actually.
I would too. Something that is more holistic,
mm-hmm.
and that helps accountants, helps clients, helps build a better world. One GL at a time.
I can't even tell you how much I've been thinking about that, right? Because as an accountant, all the accountants I know, we know the joy of a good bank rec.
Yes.
Like, right? You get that little mm-hmm. endorphin rush. Mm-hmm. And you know, or when you look at a balance sheet and you know that every number on those financials is right. And you had, mm-hmm. you could prove it if you had to, and you I think there's an existential joy in that.
Yes.
And yet the rest of our lives seem so chaotic. Like if we can strive to bring that sort of joy and that sort of balance in sort of increasing concentric circles out into our spheres, you know, with all the people that we relate to and the people we relate to, right? I could see that could bring a lot of positivity.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's the perfect place to end our conversation. Thank you so much, Megan. It's so wonderful to see your beautiful face again. And I look forward to seeing you in person again sometime. Now, if listeners want to connect with you, where's the best place to find you?
You can find me on all the socials at Megan Tarno, but my favorite's probably Twitter. So go look for me there.
Yes, she is worth following on Twitter. All right. Thank you very much. And you have a wonderful rest of your day.
All right. Thanks, Liz. You too.
Thank you for listening to the CPA Trendlines podcast, a production of CPATrendlines.com, now available on iTunes. We hope you'll rate and review us wherever you find your podcasts to help other accountants find our show more easily. For more information, you can go to CPATrendlines.com.